All right. I should remind everyone these were meant to be very informal lectures where you interrupt as often as you like. So we actually communicate information rather than contentful information rather than having it just be a talk. And so in that spirit, first of all, I'm reminding you of that. Secondly, what I'd like to do in the sort of first part of today is finish essentially still kinematics. Now, fancier and fancier kinematics and better and better and better ways of talking about the amplitude, simpler and simpler ways, simpler and simpler variables, with some hints of what the underlying, what some of the underlying structure is. And then maybe after the tea break, even more informally, whoever is interested with zero obligation, I can talk about some much newer developments, including developments actually from the last few months that have not haven't appeared in the literature yet, but which are at least to me starting to make a much much clearer geometric picture for what's actually going on. So anyone who's interested in hearing about that in more detail, we can do that afterwards. And please, anyone should feel free to walk out at any moment. I will feel no offense, although I will remember. But no, I'm kidding. after dinner, I can tell you my fantasies, Martin. I'm staying at the Motel 6. You know. yeah. I don't think so. Oh no, sorry. There's another lecture by me tomorrow morning. There's David tomorrow, of course. Yeah, but this is my own last lecture. Okay, so let me first start off making a few comments about BCFW, and this is just a sequence of comments, things that you should know. First, BCFW is not restricted to four dimensions. BCFW is a general property of field theory of gauge theories and gravity in any number of dimensions. It's possible to do the BCFW shift in any number of dimensions. And so spinner helicity variables are not critical to the story at all. This is some very general property of field theory in any number of dimensions. And so just to show the shift, imagine going to coordinates. If here's particle one, and here is particle two, the momenta that your BCFW shifting, go to some frame where, for convenience, they look like that, then the momentum that you shift by, the q mu, can just be taken to be 001i, 000. And you see that has all the requisite properties that we want to have p1 plus zq and p2 minus zq both be null. And so they are. So you see, it's very important that it's complex, and there could be a plus or minus there. And it's simplest in four dimensions, so you need at least four dimensions to make this look simple. You can actually do it in three dimensions, you start having to contend with some square roots. Everything works out, but it's easiest to talk about. Secondly, masslessness is, just from the most basic point of view, we could imagine doing a five-dimensional Yang-Mills theory and interpreting the fifth component of the momenta as four-dimensional masses. So mass isn't an obstacle either. Yeah? It's not natural to say in terms of S. I mean, that's the point. It's not a complexification of S and T. So this is another technical difference with the S matrix guys. The S matrix guys were complexifying the invariants because they're obsessed with 2-to-2 scattering for one thing, and it was a bit of a pain to talk about higher point scattering and thinking about all the relations that the different Mandelson invariants satisfied and so on. Here you just directly complexify momenta. Okay. However, the z goes to infinity limit has a very natural interpretation. Z goes to infinity limit is the limit of a particle with a huge, albeit complex, momentum blasting through a soft background, right? Because 1 and 2 become infinite, equal, and opposite in this complex direction. So it's a particle with complex momentum blasting through a soft background. Two, the behavior at infinity can be summarized under the shift as follows. I mean, so Ruth said it, but let me just say it again. For Yang-Mills theory, this goes like 1 over z if 1 and 2 are adjacent in color, and it goes like 1 over z squared if 1 and 2 are not adjacent in color. Okay, and this is to be contrasted with the one comment. But remember, this was only for the good ones. Then there was a bad one that goes like z cubed. Okay, now the behavior for gravity is that m good of z goes like 1 over z squared. There's no adjacent or non-adjacent, so it just goes like 1 over z squared, and m bad goes like z to the sixth. Okay. So you can see, and in the case of, already for Yang-Mills theory, it was surprising that these things died at infinity. You could come up with this Feynman diagram argument for some of the components, the other ones were surprising. For gravity, it's massively surprising because there are so many z's in the vertices that you would actually expect it to blow up like powers of z with higher and higher powers for more and more particles. But not only does it not do that, the expectation is once again the opposite of what you get from Feynman diagrams, and it's actually softer for gravity than for gauge theory. And you see this pattern that gravity goes like gauge theory squared again, just in this behavior as z goes to infinity. Okay. So there turns out to be a simple explanation. I won't go into it. Explanation for this behavior that really exploits this physical picture that it's a hard particle blasting through a soft background. And the fact that it's this hard and what's actually governing this pattern is an enhanced symmetry in the limit as the momentum goes to infinity. This is an enhanced symmetry very well known to people like Lev, which is also very familiar in the Iconal approximation, that you don't have helicity flips. Okay, in the limit, as you have a hard particle blasting through a soft background, you don't have helicity flips. In a language, it can be described as an enhanced sort of spin Lorentz symmetry. And there's none of those symmetries for scalars. There's one copy of that symmetry for Yang-Mills and two copies, because there's two helicity components for gravity. So the symmetries get bigger and bigger, and that's what governs this behavior. Okay, so it's a very general thing, but it's something that's very surprising from the point of view of Feynman diagrams, and you have to do quite an analysis. Again, even though this nice argument exists about blasting through a soft background, it's not a trivial argument. You have to think, choose gauges, know what it is that you're looking for in order to approve it. It's not something that field theory hands you on a plate, okay? But it is true. Oh, so for example, in four dimensions, good was shifting minus plus, and bad was minus plus, minus minus, or plus plus. These were good, and bad was shifting plus minus. Okay, you're going to ignore all this in a second, because this is actually, there's no real distinction between good and bad. That's the next thing that I'm just about to say. Okay. Oh, but before I get to that. So maybe I'll say that next. Okay. So three, actually everything is good. It's, I think the one of the a lesson that's learned in this business over and over and over again is if anything looks a little bit ugly, it's your fault. The theory is perfect, and it's your fault for not teasing out its seeing its perfection. So in this case, in fact, you see. So remember, I told you that we can use supersymmetry, if absolutely nothing else, as a great way of unifying all these helicities into the same multiplet. And again, remember, the tree amplitudes are exactly the same, whether the theory is supersymmetric or not. And we're talking about tree amplitudes here. So let's just go back to four dimensions for a second. It's true in any number of dimensions. Let's just go back to a four dimensions. So remember, the helicity components are not the natural components supersymmetrically, are not the natural objects. The natural objects are things that depend on lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. Okay. And so when we're doing these shifts on the lambdas and the lambda tildes for individual helicity components, that's not a very natural thing to do supersymmetrically. After all, why is it that we shift lambda and lambda tilde? We want to conserve momentum, trivially, right? But then we should also make sure that we're conserving the superpartner of momentum. That's the natural supersymmetric thing to do. So remember, we had this factor delta 4. This is momentum conservation. But there's also this factor delta 8, the sum of lambda a, eta tilde a. And so if you're going to shift lambda 1, you're not preserving the supermomentum conservation. So the natural thing to do is to shift lambda, lambda tilde, as well as one of the two eta tildes in order to eat up that transformation there. Okay? So that's the natural super BCFW shift. Okay? And under the super BCFW shift, all amplitudes die like 1 over z, because there's no helicity difference, right? Everything is just in etas. All amplitudes die like 1 over z if they're adjacent for Yang-Mills, 1 over z squared if non-adjacent, and 1 over z squared in gravity. Yes?
The last statement made it sound like your direction four is kind of special vector. Is that more general than that?
It's more general than that, but I'm just saying it in this case. It's since we just talked about this notation before, I'm saying it in this case. But it is more general than that. Okay. Yes. Adjacent to non-adjacent, so adjacent is always 1 over z, non-adjacent is 1 over z, is 1 over z squared. So again, it's absolutely fascinating that gravity, once again, instead of being horrendously behaved, is the softest thing of all in the UV, in this particular sense. Okay. Yes? No, but again, it's trees. So it's trees. So what this is telling you is that So of course there's no difference between the tree amplitudes for n equals 8 and for gravity. Now, if you want to take this statement and translate it into a statement about components, it tells you, yeah, you can go ahead and do the shift if you want on the plus or minus. But you have to do a crazy-looking compensating shift on all the scalars and all the other fields at the same time and add up all these funny amplitudes in order to get the answer. You would never think of doing that not non-supersymmetrically. But obviously, that's the point of having some nice something that unifies all the objects into one. And incidentally, that tells you that there's actually a second BCFW formula. The second BCFW formula is the one where you do the wrong shift. In other words, because I'm allowed to, I can do any shift that I want so long as I do it supersymmetrically. But I can do the one that appears to do the wrong thing on the other components. And so yet another way of saying this is that BCFW breaks parity. So breaks manifest parity. So there's two parity conjugate forms of BCFW supersymmetrically. So I've written on the top board the formula Ruth wrote down that you get directly from the standard non-supersymmetric BCFW recursion relations. And the bottom one, which looks kind of similar but with this funny numerator, is what you would get from what you might call the parity conjugate form. And those are nothing other, there's one and the same superamplitude, different components of it. I can compute one and the same superamplitudes and take and get the same component in two different ways. The top one is BCFW, the bottom one is the parity conjugate form of BCFW. But you would never get the bottom one just by playing with the BCFW rules as Ruth described them yesterday. You really need to see the supersymmetric extension to see the bottom formula. Yes? 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 In gauge theory, right. Sure, right. No, in I agree. For Yang-Mills, it's not so bad. For Yang-Mills, it's not so bad. For gravity, forget it. Okay, for gravity, there's no, there were, but they're very complicated diagrammatic arguments. for such a simple result. Okay, so, let me make a final comment about that formula, about the, which we also talked about yesterday, which is this fact that this formula is shockingly compact. There's three terms, but that the terms had spurious poles. Okay, so the spurious poles were these two funny bottom guys, and if you like, these are things that that look like 1/sum of p1. That's like p5 plus p6 squared. That corresponds to that pole. There's p4, 5, 6 squared. But these are things that would look like 1/p² q² - r² t², something like that. It has absolutely no interpretation in terms of local propagation in space-time. So, so somehow, that's one of the things that Feynman diagrams make manifest at cost, is that things are manifestly local. So we're seeing some interesting fact already. The incredibly simple answer is expressed in a form that's not manifestly local. The individual pieces are not manifestly local. And you can see that the spurious poles come in pairs, but if you want an exercise to spend a weekend or a week or 10 days or 14 days, I won't tell you how long I spent on it, take this formula and prove to yourself that the spurious poles cancel. It's a hellish algebraic exercise. Not at all obvious that the spurious poles cancel. Okay? It's really remarkably, it's a very non-trivial fact that the spurious poles cancel when expressed directly in that form. Okay? Now, we now have a better understanding for why it is that these things have spurious poles. It's not some sort of accidental fact. It's not some curiosity. It's a very deep fact. It's a deep fact because we also understand something that the individual BCFW terms do, which is remarkable. The individual BCFW terms are things that manifest all of the symmetries of the theory. Not only the conformal invariants, but also the dual conformal invariants that you were hearing about from Johannes earlier today. That's, we now understand, the real invariant content of the individual BCFW terms. They're building blocks of things which are invariant under all the symmetries of the theory. This infinite dimensional Yangian symmetry, I don't know if Johannes said the word Yangian, but if you take the conformal symmetry and the dual conformal symmetry, they don't commute with each other, obviously. They generate an infinite dimensional group known as a Yangian of the conformal group, so the Yangian of SL4, SU2, 2, 4. We'll talk about the symmetries in a bit. But there's no way that anything which is, it would be shocking if individual building blocks that were invariant under both symmetries were local, because they don't have either space-time as their master, right? They're treating both the original and the dual space-time completely symmetrically. So it would be crazy for them to be local. That's why they're not local. In fact, they're telling you, they don't give a crap about either one of the space-times. They care quintessentially, they care simply about the symmetry properties and nothing else. That's one fascinating fact. The amplitudes are simple when expressed in terms of objects that aren't local. It's just telling you there's something wrong with the, or there's at least another better way of organizing our thinking that doesn't make locality so manifest, A. B, we then learned that these objects are Yangian invariant. They're a whole set of objects which are Yangian invariant, small subset of them, but it's the first set that you run into. And the final thing is that somehow these objects have to satisfy very interesting identities. They have to satisfy properties that makes it possible for them to be put together in such a way that the answer is local in the end of the day. Okay? You have to, if someone handed you these objects and said, here are the Yangian invariants, go ahead and build something local. If they handed them to me, I'd say, screw you. There's no way, right? I can't put these, sure they come in pairs. It doesn't look like at all like they cancel. If I cancel this pair, then the other pair's got to cancel there, then it's got a pair. It seems completely crazy that these things are all going to cancel, okay? And yet it is possible for them all to cancel. That's the remarkable thing. Now, let me give you a flavor of how you see that these things can cancel, and how these sort of remarkable, the sharp way that these remarkable facts are encoded. Another feature of BCFW is that it is not manifestly cyclic. We start with this nice cyclic superamplitude, and we break the cyclicity by picking two legs to a deform. So we get a decomposition of an object that should be cyclic in terms of building blocks that are not manifestly cyclic. So that means there's many different ways of doing BCFW. Okay? So that's another funny thing. You know, we have lots of different representations of the same object, each one of them which looks different, but they sum to the same thing. No one of them is particularly preferred over any other one. So just with these building blocks, you would want to check or see, is the amplitude parity invariant? Is it cyclic? Is it local? Okay? These are all checks that you have to do that have to be interesting identities on this object. Now, for this particular six-particle amplitude, all of these facts boil down to one single identity, which is the equality of these two guys. Okay? So that's a remarkable six-term identity that has to be true. See, there's three terms at the top and three terms at the bottom. Okay? This is a true fact. This is a true identity. If you like, you could say that quantum field theory proves this identity, because we derive these things from the field theory. So this is a fantastic identity that is the consequence of deriving amplitudes from BCFW through field theory by going through all the arguments that Ruth went through yesterday, right? Form, then you go through some argument about why amplitudes vanish at infinity, use Cauchy's theorem, and then you find that you can express the answer in this way. And since you knew it came from something that was cyclic and parity invariant and everything, then these are all identities that have to be true. So that's one way of proving these amazing identities. But what we're going to see, especially a little later, is that these identities also come from somewhere else. Okay? And they reflect some remarkable geometric structure that seems to be algebraic geometric structure that's controlling them. But just to see, so there's some six-term identity between these rational functions. It's the simplest non-trivial identity of an example of an infinite class of identities like this that have to be satisfied. But let me just point out that if you believe that identity, if you somehow manage to prove it, for instance, you prove that all the spurious poles cancel. The reason is that the spurious poles are different on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of these expressions. So if you manage to prove this identity, then you prove that all the spurious poles cancel. But, you know, this is not the way to go. At 7 points, you need a 12-term identity. At 8 points, you need a 40-term identity. You know, proving these identities by hand is not, one has to have a deeper understanding for where they come from. All right, so at least in four dimensions, and likely actually in higher dimensions, because as I mentioned this morning, we know that, not likely, we know the tree amplitudes in higher dimensions are also dual conformal invariant. We know that they can be computed using BCFW, and the BCF and the way you prove that they're dual conformal invariant is, once again, in any number of dimensions, the BCFW terms are individually dual conformal invariant. So they're exposing a symmetry that's utterly invisible in the Lagrangian term by term. Okay. All right. So now let me move on to say a few things quickly. David's going to tell you all about loop integrals tomorrow, but I just want to say a few quick things about them now. So what we've seen at tree level is that the singularity structure, together with the surprisingly good behavior at infinity, allows us to completely determine tree amplitudes. Okay? And they're built out of objects that seem to have a life of their own that we're going to spend more time talking about. So one would hope that the same thing can be extended to loop order. And indeed, for n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, it's possible to extend the BCFW recursion relations to determine the integrand of the theory to all loop order. So there's an explicit recursive formula. You just add one more term to the BCFW recursion relations. You can put it on Mathematica. You press return, and you have the 4-loop 17-particle integrand sitting in your laptop. Okay? There's nothing. You don't. Just like at tree level, there's nothing to it. It's just a recursive formula. Shift enter, and you have it. And I might, I'll probably describe it in a little, I'll describe it in a little more detail later. But the bottom line is the same thing. Each term in this construction is manifestly Yangian invariant. And this invariant under conformal dual conformal, this invariant under the manifest Yangian symmetry is possible because we're it's possible to see very cleanly because we're setting the theory at the level of the integrand. So I just want to pause for a second to talk about the idea of the integrand. I should have said this is all in the planar limit. The integrand, the loop integrand, and the idea of leading singularities, another very important idea. So, of course, famously, the actual integrals, the actual loop amplitudes for massless particles have infrared divergences. And so that's a thicket that you have to look through in order to try to understand the what's going on. Talking about the integrand rather than the integral itself is an intermediate step along those lines. A very simple but very important point is that the loop integrand is actually a sensible object in a planar theory. You might think that the loop integrand is a sensible object in any theory, but it's not true. You can draw the Feynman diagrams all you want, but what you call, and you might think, let's just combine them all together under one integral sign at one loop. What's wrong? One D4L, and then you add them all up. But it's meaningless because the L in this loop and the L in that loop and the L in that loop, there's no way to pick a common origin for them in general. Okay? What do you mean by L? You can translate L by anything you want from one diagram to the other. Okay? There's no such thing as the integrand. In other words, if you sum up all Feynman diagrams, say, that's one definition, there's no unique rational function that you can possibly get out of that manipulation. However, in a planar theory, that's not true. And it's easiest to discuss using the variables Johannes talked about, where instead of, so if in the usual way we would talk about, so normally we might write something like a D4L over L squared, L plus P1 squared, L plus P1 plus P2 squared, L minus P4 squared, or something like that. But even this isn't so good. This is a planar diagram because who are you going to call L? Okay. However, a much more invariant thing to do is to introduce these dual coordinates, X, because X1, X2, I'm not sure I'm being consistent between one diagram and the other, but what we called L is really X minus X1, and the integral is much more canonical. It's just a D4X over X minus X1 squared, where X minus X4 squared. Okay. The reason for this is very simply the following. What is the reason that we can do this translation in loop? The only difficulty is that we can translate different diagrams by just a translation in loop momentum space. Okay. Now, but when we have planar diagrams, this freedom in translating the loop momentum from one diagram to the other corresponds to translations in this dual space. But once I just nail once and for all that the external particles are at one value of the positions in the external space, I've completely frozen that redundancy. And so I can combine all the diagrams together into one object. Okay? That's true at one loop, trivially. It's true at two loops. It's true at any number of loops. Okay? At two loops and above, you should symmetrize, obviously, in the X and the Y. So you'd have an X and a Y, you have a D4X, D4Y, but you have to symmetrize in the two variables. But that means that there is an invariant bit of data. The loop integrand exists. It's a sensible object. It's a rational function of the loop momentum variables and the external kinematics. Okay? And so the problem of determining the loop integrand, first of all, the loop integrand exists. And secondly, the second you know it exists, it's like falling off a log. You determine it the same way you determine the tree amplitude. There's some rational function. You know what its poles look like. So the generalization of BCFW to take care of that is essentially straightforward. Okay. Okay. So I might describe it a little more detail later, but let me just leave it at that for now. Now, so that's one object we should talk about. There's this big loop integrand function of external momenta and loop variables. Let's say we want to go further and start doing some integrals to actually get things where the end data doesn't depend on this loop integration variable, just depends on the external variables. Okay? So if you handed me this integral or that integral, same thing, and said, do it, well, as a physicist, I'd integrate from x from minus infinity to infinity, right? All from minus infinity to infinity, I'd integrate over real Minkowski space. And then I'd hit the infrared divergences, I'd hit all the stuff, and then I have to deal with it. But if you handed a mathematician the same integral, they're lazy people, right? So they want to do the simplest integral they possibly can. The simplest integral that you can do when you have an object with poles all over the place isn't to try to ram through the poles and regulate and do some crazy thing like that. It's a computer residue. That's the dumbest thing you could do, okay? So take this loop integrand. Imagine you have this loop integrand. It's a function of four variables at one loop, L0, L1, L2, L3, eight variables at two loops, and so on. And just compute the residues around the poles of this integral. Now, multidimensional residue is the same as a normal residue. Here, we have four integration variables, so we have to find a place where there are four poles downstairs. If there's one pole downstairs, it would be like when we run into dz over z, we just legislate that to 1. Sorry, 2 pi I, d slash z, okay? And so what? So you have now a function of many variables here, but imagine you find a location where four of the propagators go to 0. Then in the neighborhood of that location, just change variables to the things that are about to go to 0. In that neighborhood, by definition, it looks like, let's say those new variables are u. It's going to look like du1 over u1, du4 over u4. There's some Jacobian that makes it look like that. Okay. And so what is the residue at that point? Well, you just legislate all of these things to 1. And so the residue is just equal to this Jacobian, the change of variables that takes you from one to the other. Okay? So that's just all exactly the same as for a function of one variable. Okay? So if someone hands you an integrand, it can have many poles all over the place in the complex plane. Now, so these things where you get to set as many guys to 0 as possible, the highest codimension singularities are called leading singularities. And the residues around them are also called leading singularities. It's an abusive terminology. But the leading singularities are nothing other than the residues of the Feynman, are just the complex residues of the Feynman integrals. Okay. So if you like, the leading singularities are just doing the loop integral on a different contour. It's doing it on a contour that's little circles around the places where it has singularities rather than trying to ram through them and do the whole big integral. Okay? So this is clearly data about the loop integral. And if someone hands you the loop integrand, there are tons of leading singularities, not just one or two. There are tons of leading singularities. In fact, at one loop, it's easy to figure out what all the leading singularities are. And of course, they're in general at complex values of the momentum, of the loop momenta, okay? Because it's all complex. We're solving these quadratic equations downstairs all over the place to put these propagators on shell. But what can they look like? Well, because we know that all the singularities are in Feynman propagators, the most general singularity you can have at one loop, leading singularity, if you just imagine, you have to find a place where four propagators go on shell at the same time. Okay, find a place in complex L space where four propagators go on shell at the same time. So that corresponds to breaking the external particles up into four sets in all possible ways. Any given way of breaking it up into four sets, you draw this picture. And now because these lines are on shell, that's a triamplitude, that's a triamplitude, that's a triamplitude, that's a triamplitude. Okay, so the leading singularities are simply, the leading singularity of one loop are simply evaluated by taking these triamplitudes, evaluated, it remembers that it's coming from a loop integral, because it's evaluated in the place where these lines are made to go on shell, okay? But you put them together, and that gives you the answer for the loop integral on a little toroidal contour around that particular singularity, okay? Now, leading singularities contain super invariance information about the theory. The reason is that any symmetries the theory has, whatever's going on, should be completely unobstructed in the leading singularities because there's no infrared divergences, no divergences of any sort. You're just doing the integrals on the contour that that's simplest to do and which is totally unobstructed by any other funny issues. Okay. So these are a set of tree amplitudes are rational functions. These are in general algebraic functions. You can have square roots and higher roots and so on because we're solving these polynomial equations to put the propagators to zero. So this is a whole suite of data about the theory, which should reflect whatever's going on in it. Okay? Totally unobstructed by infrared divergences or any other funny issues. Okay? All right? And actually, when you start looking at leading singularities in field theories, let me make a quick comment now about n equals 4 versus other theories. The remarkable thing, this is the most singular piece of the loop integral. Okay? We can have lower codimension singularities, right? I can imagine three propagators go on shell, and I still have one loop integral to do. I have one integral to do instead of four integrals. Okay? That's called a triple cut. I could put two of them on shell and now do the integral of the other ones. That's a unitarity cut. Okay? So the special thing about n equals 4 is that knowing these leading singularities specifies everything else. Notice these are the most complicated, they're the most singular things. Okay? But knowing them specifies everything else. What happens in QCD is that you can actually match all the leading singularities. In other words, you can compute all the leading singularities in QCD, you know what they are, and then you can try to make an ansatz for what the amplitude is that agrees with these perfect leading singularities. What you find is that ansatz fails to capture all of the sub-leading singularities. And that's why, you know, this picture, what David will I'm sure tell you about tomorrow, that one loop amplitudes are written in terms of boxes, triangles, bubbles, rational pieces, and so on. This is a sort of deep fact about the singularity structure that you're allowed to have. Okay? It's boxes because we live in four dimensions, and the highest sort of singularity that I can have involves putting four propagators on shell. It's just that does not suffice for QCD, and that's why you need triangles and bubbles and the rational pieces as well. Okay? But notice that this is, in a sense, the most, what you would naively think of as the most complicated part of the theory. It's the most complicated part, which is being captured by these leading singularities. All right. And let me say one more thing about leading. So you can compute leading singularities in QCD in n equals 4 in any theory you like. But let's just talk about it in n equals 4. If you start computing leading singularities, you discover that they have remarkable properties. First of all, as it turns out, they are also all Yangian invariant. Of course, you would expect it because they're supposed to be telling you about nothing should be obstructing the symmetries of the theory. Secondly, they satisfy tons of crazy identities just like these BCFW terms. In fact, BCF before W derived the BCF recursion relations by actually recognizing those terms as specific kinds of leading singularities. So this is not an accident, but I won't say more about that. So they satisfy lots of remarkable identities between each other. And perhaps the most surprising property that they have, you might not be so terribly surprised that they satisfy lots of identities, because those identities reflect things like unitarity. They reflect things like, and they reflect unitarity and locality. But the most shocking thing is that there are not that many leading singularities. So that's what one loop leading singularities look like. I can draw leading singularities at two loops. So at two loops, I have eight integration variables. And so you have to find eight propagators to cut, at least naively. So you imagine finding situations like that where there's eight things that you can cut. Okay? So once again, you put tree amplitudes together, you glue them together into a picture like that, you evaluate them at the place where all these things go on shell, and that gives you some information about that's the two loop amplitude evaluated on a particular contour, on a nice contour. Now, you would think that you have as many leading singularities, you get just more and more and more of them as you go to higher and higher loops. Let's take the simplest amplitudes, the MHV amplitudes. You compute the one loop leading singularity. In other words, you take these diagrams, you glue the tree diagrams together in such a way that the external helicities are consistent with MHV, and you might expect to get a generic algebraic function with some square roots in it or something. You don't. What you get is just the MHV tree amplitude, again. It's a rational function, it's the MHV tree amplitude. You go to two loops, you glue things together like this in every possible way, you get the MHV tree amplitude again. You draw 100 loop diagrams, you glue them together any way you want, you get the MHV tree amplitude again. There's a unique leading singularity for MHV, it's the MHV tree amplitude. Okay. Totally unobvious from drawing Feynman diagrams. Okay. Another, and that of course fact keeps on going. If you go to next MHV amplitudes, at one loop you get a suite of objects, and then that's all you ever get for six cycles. You don't get anything new at two, three loop, they just exhaust at one loop. In fact, all NMHV amplitudes, the leading singularities are exhausted at three loops. You don't get anything new. So there are some, this is telling you that there's some remarkable structure that's totally invisible in the loop expansion. That's telling you that there's something that stops. As you go to higher loops, you don't get anything new. Okay. These are all things that we understand sort of perfectly now, but I'm telling you from the point of view of the sort of data that there's some properties here. This is the sort of quintessence of the scattering amplitudes, right? It's the unadorned, it's the totally unobstructed view into what they look like locally everywhere, and they have some astonishing property that you would just never guess staring at Feynman diagrams. Okay, so we'll explain where those come from for those of you who are interested to come back after tea. Okay. Okay. But maybe I'll say that a little more precisely later. The Engen symmetry is what you get when you take conformal symmetry and dual conformal symmetry, and you just commute them together. Okay, so that generates an infinite dimensional algebra. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That's an excellent question. So you see, so. Yes. So you have to be Freddy Cachazzo. Only Freddy Cachazzo would look at that picture and see an eighth propagator that you can cut. But that's why it's not me. Okay. So indeed. So that there's a. Yes, that's right. Yes, it's very similar to that. Yes, it is very similar to that. So what happens? So I was a little glib in the theory of higher point residues. Okay. The most naive kind of residue that you can define when you have multi-dimensional variables is one where you just look for, if you have n variables, look for n poles, and then you just do what I said. But that's not necessary. All you need is to find a singularity of the appropriate codimension. It doesn't matter whether you arrive at that singularity by intersecting n codimension 1 surfaces together. You could get them any way you want. Here is the most basic example. If you have a function of three complex variables, and it looks like 1 over x times x plus yz. You wouldn't think that you can find, on general grounds, that you can find a residue, because there's only two poles, not three. And if I put x over x plus yz plus a general constant a, there's nothing you can do for a general constant a. However, when a equals 0, something special happens, because if you ignore the general theorem and you say, let me first put x to 0, on the support of x equals 0, the second factor factorizes. And you can then put y and z to 0 separately. And that's, that. More invariantly put, what the geometry looks like in the neighborhood of that singularity is a point. Right? For a general A, it's a hyperbola. But at that point, it just happens to be the product of two lines, and you find a point. So all you have to do is to find a point. And this is actually not a very well-developed area of multidimensional complex analysis, and a lot of anyway. But for our purposes, it's completely understood. And anyway, so this is the sort of thing that you look for. So that's what happens in this case. You find when you cut enough of these things that something else factorizes, and that you can actually cut another line and define a leading singularity. Okay. Sorry. The point is where when some of these momenta on the edges are set to zero. Okay, so The same thing, by the way, exactly the same thing happens. So exactly the same thing happens. Let me give you an even simpler example. People aren't normally used to talking about it, but there's a composite singularity. Well, these leading singularities that are not official are called composite. There's no distinction between them, but there's already a composite leading singularity even at one loop in a diagram like this, and you find that. When you have so many massless lines, on the support of cutting this guy, on the support of cutting this guy, that propagator factorizes, and you can cut it twice in exactly the same way. Okay? So you can get cuts that look like that. Instead of just getting, obviously you can get these cuts, but on the support of putting that and that to zero, you can cut that one twice. We can go through the algebra, but it's actually it'll be more obvious with other variables that I'm about to talk about in a bit. So, it just means that on the support of putting these to zero, this factor factorizes into the product of two pieces, just like that x times x plus y z example. On the support of x equals zero, the second factor piece factorizes into two. Huh? No. They're very different things. Yes. No. You don't. But, well, can we talk about this later? No. But you see, because when you have the this is really a very minor point. So I'd be happy to talk about it at great length. And ultimately, there's actually no real distinction between them. Maybe if you don't mind, I'll defer the discussion. Sorry, this was meant to be done in 15 minutes, and okay. I didn't mean to spend so much time talking about the loops. I mostly just wanted to alert you to the existence of these leading singularities. Okay, so I now want to talk about the symmetries of the. So finishing the kinematic discussion, and I first. So the goal now is to learn to talk about the symmetries in the simplest possible language. So let's talk about conformal symmetries in general. And of course, as you all know, the real juice of conformal symmetries, it's not the dilations, is the inversions, which are a crazy, remarkable thing, which you wouldn't very naively expect a theory to have. And you combine an inversion with the infinitesimal translations to get the special conformal transformations. But that's something else which is strange about the usual way of talking about things. When we write down Lagrangians, when we talk about the different symmetries in the conformal group in a totally different way. The generators are treated in a completely asymmetric way. Translations, Lorentzian rotations, and special conformal transformations are very different looking generators, right? DDX, XDDX, XXDDX, they're very different looking generators. It's a symmetry, so we should learn to talk about these things in as simple a way as possible. And there are many motivations for twister space, but this is one of the best ones. Okay? Twister variables are just the most natural variables with which to talk about theories that have a conformal symmetry. Okay. So in order to begin motivating the construction, remember that if you have two points, x1 and x2, under inversions, x1 minus x2 squared isn't invariant. It goes to x1 minus x2 squared over x1 squared x2 squared. So, of course, distances aren't invariant. However, if the two points are null separated, if x1 minus x2 squared is equal to 0, then null separation is a conformally invariant concept. Two points are null separated, then under inversions, the corresponding two points are null separated. And therefore, the notion of a null ray in space-time is a conformally invariant notion. So if you have a null ray in space-time under conformal transformations, it goes to another ray, but it's still a null ray in space-time. And this, together with sort of very, very modern holographic sounding motivations, is what led Penrose to think about twister variables. He wanted to think about conformal transformations as nicely as possible, and he also said, because of gravity, the inside of a space-time fluctuates, we shouldn't be allowed to talk about individual points. Let's instead talk about things that go out to the boundary at infinity, where we have control. Okay? So let's just try to figure out how to talk about null rays nicely. Remember, everything is complex. Everything is complex. How would we write down an equation for a null ray? Well, you want to write down a linear equation, where the solutions of those equations all lie in a null line. Well, the nicest way of doing it is by working with the alpha alpha dot variables and looking at this. Sorry. Looking at that linear equation. Okay. So if I hand you a mu and a lambda, so the mu and lambda are sort of data here. If I hand you as data mu and lambda, look at all the solutions to this equation, all the solutions x alpha alpha dot of this equation. It's easy to see that that's a null line, right? If you take two points that are on this line, two points, x1 and x2, if I take the difference between these two equations, it's x1 minus x2 lambda is equal to 0, that means that x1 minus x2 has a 0 eigenvector. That means that it has a vanishing determinant. So any two points on this line are null separated from each other. Okay. So that's the first basic correspondence, is that a null ray in space-time, so if this is space-time and this is twister space, a null ray in space-time corresponds to a point with coordinates mu and lambda in twister space. Okay. Now, of course, I could rescale this equation by any constant, and I won't change what the line is. So there's a redundancy. This guy, so if I call this variable z, and any constant times z, non-zero constant times z, should be identified. They correspond to the same line. And that's why the z's don't live in CP4, they don't live in C4 like you would think, but they're really elements of CP3. But you can always think of them as a four vector, as long as anything you do with that four-dimensional vector is invariant under rescaling. Okay. All right. Now the second basic correspondence, now let's see what is nice about this. Given the fact that the null line is invariant, null lines go to null lines under conformal transformations, we should expect that the conformal transformations act nicely on these variables, and they do. Conformal transformations act just as z goes to LZ, where L is in SL4. Any linear 4x4 linear transformation. So the two Lorentzes are obvious, SL2 and SL2 acts on these guys. But for example, what are inversions? Look at this equation, mu minus x lambda equals 0, divide by x squared, lambda minus x over x squared mu is equal to 0. And so we see that the inverted point goes with the coordinates lambda mu. So inversions are the totally trivial linear transformation that interchanges mu and lambda. Okay. These special conformal transformations are one of the 2x2 blocks, and translations are the other one. So look at translations, right? If you say x goes to x plus constant, that's just translating mu goes to mu plus something times lambda. Okay. So all of the conformal transformations are beautifully just these trivial 4x4 linear transformations. Okay. That means that you don't have to think about metrics, you don't have to think about light cones. All you have to do is think about projective geometry in three dimensions. And projective geometry means logic. Any statement is about whether lines are lying in planes, intersecting with each other, whether points are on lines, contained in planes, and so on. There's no distance, so everything is rules of incidence and nothing else. The only invariant tensor is the epsilon tensor. There's nothing else you can do. So for instance, and this really makes it much easier to think about Minkowskian geometry, conformal geometry in general. So for instance, so before giving an example, let me finish the very basic correspondences. So we see that so conformal transformations act like SL4. Now let's imagine we have two points in twister space. This is now in twister space. Okay. So point mu A lambda A and mu B lambda B. This guy is a null ray in space-time. That guy is a null ray in space-time. These two null rays intersect at a point. Real null rays don't intersect at a point, but the complex null rays intersect at a point. And you don't need to visualize it. You can just write down the equations. It's mu minus x lambda equals 0. Mu b minus the same x lambda b equals 0. Okay. So I can just solve for x from these two equations. And the solution is x equals mu a lambda b minus mu b lambda a over a b. Lambda a lambda b. Okay. So associated with two points in twister space, those two lines intersect at a point. Now you'll notice I can do any 2x2 linear transformation I want on these equations, and I won't change the solution, x. So that also tells you that there's a redundancy. If I take two A and B, and I take any linear combination of these two, if I do any 2x2 linear transformation on A and B, I'm going to get the same point in spacetime. Any 2x2 linear transformation just moves A and B along the line that joins them. Okay. So that's the second part of the correspondence, is that a line in twister space with two representatives on it, if I like, A and B, corresponds to a point in space-time, X, AB, and we just gave the formula for it, okay? Or X, mu A lambda B, minus mu B lambda A, over AB. All right. So as I said, so now we know how to go back and forth between null rays and points in space-time and a twister space. So for instance, and every conformally invariant relationship in space-time, in twister space, is reflected as just statements about whether things intersect, things lie in things, just projectively invariant statements. So the simplest example is if you have two points in space-time, x and y, and these two points are null separated from each other, what does that mean in twister space? This is a line in twister space. That's a line in twister space. And what could it possibly mean that they're not separated? The only thing it can mean is that these lines intersect each other. Okay. So this is a line corresponding to x. This is a line corresponding to y, and they intersect. Okay. As a little example of how this makes visualizing conformal geometry much, much easier, just a very brief example, just to have a little bit of fun. Let's actually go back to this problem. Let's say we have a totally general, completely general one loop diagram, and we're trying to find this leading singularity where we cut all four propagators. Okay? So that's solving four quadratic equations, L squared equals 0, L plus that. Say that's K1, K2, K3, K4. Right? So that's solving four coupled quadratic equations, right? Now, let's just rephrase that slightly in these dual diagrams. In these dual diagrams, that's just like we have four points, x1, x2, x3, x4, and we're looking to find a fifth point, x, which is null separated from all four of them, okay? Because that one is like L1, that one's L2, and so on. So that's an incredibly basic problem that just in finding the first cuts in the first leading singularities at one loop turns into this simple sounding geometry problem in Minkowski space. Find, given four points in Minkowski space, find a fifth point which is null separated from all four of them. Okay. Now how would I go about doing it? I have absolutely no intuition for it at all. You just start writing down the equations, okay? Start writing down the equations, and there's just zero insight, at least for me, into what happens. But for example, ahead of time, how many solutions should there be? I would have said 16, because it's four quadratic equations, because I'm an idiot, right? But it turns out there's two solutions, okay? But why? What do the solutions look like? How can you visualize this? Okay, it's utterly trivial in twister space. I should have mentioned that because this is CP3, projective geometry in three dimensions, the complex part hardly matters for thinking about the geometry. You can visualize it as just lines and planes in three dimensions, ordinary three dimensions. What it means to be in CP3 means that you take your vectors, you rescale the top component to be one, and all the other vectors are just some three-dimensional vector. So everything is just lines and planes and points in three dimensions. You just have to remember, as usual in projective geometry, that everything intersects everything that's allowed by dimensionality. So if it doesn't seem to be intersecting in your picture, it's intersecting at infinity somewhere. But other than that, you can just visualize in three dimensions. So what does this problem turn into in three dimensions? Well, this problem in twister space turns into the problem. Each one of these points is a line. So given four lines, the question is to find a fifth line that intersects all four. Okay? Well, this turns out to be the first and most classic problem in enumerative geometry that was studied by Mr. Schubert in the 1850s. It's the first thing in any algebraic geometry book is a problem of finding a line intersecting four given lines in P3. It may not look so obvious that there is any solution here, but let me argue the way Mr. Schubert argued. So this general configuration seems a little bit complicated, maybe. But let's imagine taking a special configuration. Take a special configuration where some of the lines intersect each other. So here's a special configuration. Imagine my fingers here, each one of them is a line, and I'm extending them all out, okay? So these two intersect and the other two intersect. Okay, so in this configuration, how many lines are there that intersect all four? There's exactly two of them, that one and that one. So there's two lines that intersect all four. And now Schubert argued that now move the lines away into more generic positions. These are smooth equations. The number of solutions can't jump discontinuously. So it's always two solutions. Okay. That's actually the right answer. Not only is it the right answer, it tells you exactly what the configurations look like in these special cases where the lines intersect. These special cases are very useful for us because they correspond to cases where some of these lines are null lines. So when these lines are null lines, then some of these points are null separated from each other, and therefore the corresponding lines intersect. Those are the important special cases of the general box. So that's just a very simple example of how the projective geometry of a twister space makes it much easier to think about the conformal geometry in Minkowski space. Okay? All right. Now, this was the way Penrose thought about these things and was very suited to coordinate space. Okay? So this was a twister space associated with ordinary coordinate space, our ordinary coordinate space, conformal transformations in coordinate Minkowski space. Okay? When we talk about scattering amplitudes, we're more interested in ordinary momentum space. So the question is how to think about twister variables for ordinary associated with ordinary momentum space. And so from twister space to momentum space, proceeds via what's called the half Fourier transform. This is really the Penrose transform. But the Penrose transform is set and this is easiest to talk about in 2, 2 signature. So this is reflecting something that can be done in principle in any signature, but involves contour integrals, more interesting and involve contour integrals, but which in 2, 2 signature is just an ordinary Fourier transform. In order to motivate the Penrose transform, let me tell you how particle physicists could trivially derive and have thought of the Penrose transform. It's nothing other than thinking about solutions of the wave equation. So how we normally write a solution of the wave equation when we just, in our introductory courses, we start writing it as a d4p delta of p squared, some function of p, e to the I, px. Right? Right, that's a solution of the wave equation. However, it's redundant, right? We have this four integrals and we put this guy on shell. So what we normally do in teaching courses is we immediately pick a frame and we write this as a d cubed p over magnitude p f of p e to the I, you know, p dot x. And that's perfectly fine, but it's a little annoying that you have to break Lorentz invariance immediately to write a non-redundant form as a solution of the wave equation. So there's actually a nicer way of thinking about what this object is. That's Lorentz invariant. Okay. After all, p is just equal to lambda lambda tilde on the solution of the delta function. So what you'd like to do is just say this is an integral d squared lambda d squared lambda tilde, some function now of lambda and lambda tilde, e to the I lambda lambda tilde x. That's almost right, but there's four integration variables here. There should be three here because we've done the delta function. Well, but that's fine because remember, lambda and lambda tilde are redundant. We can rescale them. So the really invariant way of saying this is to put a mod GL1 here. Okay? There's a GL1 under which lambda goes to T lambda, lambda tilde goes to T inverse lambda tilde, and we just mod out by that GL1. What does that mean in practice? For example, it means I can take the lambda and put the top component of lambda to 1. And then leave lambda tilde, or the other way around. Okay? But this is this, if you like. So this is the way the PDG writes the ellipse for a single particle. Okay, but this is the correct Lorentz invariant way of writing it. Okay. Now, if we're dealing with real momenta in 3-1 signature, there's the additional fact that lambda tilde's got equal lambda star, okay? And so I can't decouple these two integrals. But let's say I'm doing this in 2, 2 signature. There's wave equation in 2-2 signature. I can write down solutions in 2-2 signature just as well. In 2-2 signature, lambda and lambda tilde are really independent real variables, right? Okay, so let me now do it in 2-2. Where lambda and lambda tilde are independent real. Well, now I can proceed and do this integral. For example, I can choose to put this GL1, just as we said, I can choose to put it on lambda, or I can choose to put it on lambda tilde. Let me choose to put it on lambda, for example. Okay. So in other words, I'm going to write this as d squared lambda over GL1. Notice that this is really saying that this is an integral over RP1, okay? And sometimes people write this measure sort of more invariantly in a way that looks like that, or equally in a way that looks like that. But it's really just d squared lambda over GL1, okay? So this is an integral over RP1. Now I can do the rest of the integral. It's just the integral d squared lambda tilde with no constraints on the lambda tilde, f of lambda and lambda tilde, e to the I lambda lambda tilde x. Well, but that's just the Fourier transform of f with respect to lambda tilde. Okay. So this is d squared lambda over GL1, this is over RP1, of this Fourier transform, which is evaluated at lambda, and the conjugate variable to lambda tilde, which we can call mu, is evaluated at x times lambda. Or mu minus x lambda equals 0. That's the Penrose transform. You see, it tells you to take a function in twister space. This is now a function of lambda and mu. So it's a function in RP3, because everything is real. Take this function in RP3. Let's draw a picture. You take this function in RP3. You find a CP1 in the RP3. So that's a little circle in the RP3. You just integrate this function that lives on RP3 over this little CP1, and where you evaluate its mu component to equal x lambda, where x is the point in spacetime you're interested in computing the solution of the wave equation. Okay? So this is 5x. Oh, sorry, it's RP1. That's a 1. Huh? This is a one-dimensional integral. It's a d squared lambda over gl1. So that's an integral over RP1. So the function f lives in all of Twister space, which is RP3. But I'm doing an integral. I'm doing an integral along a one-dimensional slice inside the RP3, which is just this RP1 that lives inside the RP3 of the function, and I just evaluate the other component at x lambda, where x is the point in space-time that I'm interested in. Yes, yes, this is everything is real. So right, so the official Penrose transform is in CP3. So the general complex statement is that you have functions in CP3, you find a CP1 in the CP3, and you do a contour integral around the CP1 of the function evaluated at x lambda. I didn't want to go through that in too much detail. I just want you to see why it's very natural to do this half Fourier transform. Okay? And you see this is a natural way. Fourier transform with respect to one or the other variable is a natural way to go from momentum space into Twister space. Let's see another beautiful thing about going from momentum space into a Twister space by this Fourier transform. Remember, it's very annoying that under this little group action, lambda and lambda tilde scale oppositely. They want to be projective variables, but you can't. You have to choose one or the other to projectivize, right? However, after the Fourier transformation, the Fourier conjugate variables all have the same scaling. And so little group scaling just turns into overall projective scaling of the variables in Twister space. So even from that point of view, if you want the amplitudes to have the simplest possible transformation properties under little group scaling, the simplest variables are the conjugate ones in Twister space. Let me give you two tiny examples of what actual amplitudes look like in Twister space. And I should say that this Twister space story has not played, I mean, it played a very, very big role when Witten started talking about Twister string theory. In the latest developments in the past couple of years, it has not played as active a role, but I think it's a, you know, ultimately it's there and everything is going to make sense in every picture, which is why I want to talk about it here. Also because this is the picture which is directly tied to space-time. It has nothing to do with planarity. It should work for gravity. It should be, you know, this is something very general, whereas a lot of the developments now using the momentum twister variables I'm going to talk about in a moment are very special to planar theories and so on, despite the fact that they've allowed a huge amount of progress. But so that's why I just want to give you two quick examples. First example is let's look at an MHV amplitude. Okay. So let's just look at a factor. Let me not bother with the numerator. You see, even this prefactor isn't going to matter. Sum of lambda a, lambda tilde a. Okay. Let's say I have this as a function of lambda and lambda tilde. And now it's very important that we include the momentum conserving delta function. And let's look at what this looks like in Twister space. Now, we have many choices for how to go to Twister space. We can Fourier transform with respect to lambda or the lambda tilde. And also the different helicities. We can choose how to transform them. Even supersymmetrically, we can choose whether to transform the etas or the eta tildes. But anyway, I'm just doing it non-supersymmetrically here. And so if I want to do a Fourier transform with respect to some variable of this function, the one that you would really want to transform first is which should not be lambda, right? Because it's sitting in these scary poles. So let's transform with respect to lambda tilde. Okay? So I just want to now Fourier transform with respect to d squared lambda tilde for all the a's, e to the I lambda tilde a, mu a, that's the conjugate variable, let me put a minus there, of this guy. So that's good. That all comes out. It's untouched. But now to do that, I'm going to Fourier represent the delta function. So it's e to the I x sum over a, lambda tilde a. Okay. So that's nice. Now I can do the reverse the integration order and do the lambda integral, right? So what do I get? I get the the trivial prefactor, which isn't doing anything, a d4x times a delta squared from each one of these guys. For each a, the product of a delta squared, mu a minus x lambda a. And at this point, we can't proceed further to explicitly evaluate this integral. Okay, so we have to leave it in this form. But this form already has a remarkable feature. Right? This tells you that all of the mu a and lambda a, all these points in twister space, all these points correspond to the same, lie on the same x. That means that all these points in twister space lie in a line. So the amplitude has support in twister space only when particles 1, 2, 3, 4, up to n lie on a line in twister space. So you can see the functions in twister space are going to be distributional. They're not going to have some generic value when the twister variable is at random places, but they have the property that they have support on certain sorts of configurations, right? Here it has support only when the particles are all on a line. Now, this was generalized remarkably by Witten to the conjecture that's now proven and understood, well, at least proven, that all amplitudes, so this is an MHV amplitude, but an NMHV amplitude will have the property that all the points, it's only non-zero if all the points lie on a conic in twister space. Okay. And next, n squared MHV amplitude. It's non-zero unless all the points lie on what's called the twisted cubic, which is the cubic generalization of a conic in a projective spaces. Okay. All right, but just so you see, there's some very simple and beautiful structure in a twister space. Now, there is a totally complementary way of going to a twister space that exposes another structure. Okay. This time, you can really do the integral. So let's really do the integral. Here's another example. Let's take for fun the plus plus minus amplitude, just so we do another one. Okay, so this is whatever, 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3. Again, delta 4, so just the most basic three-point amplitude, the sum over a, lambda tilde a. Okay. Now we're going to go to twister space in the opposite way. So here we transform with respect to all the lambdas. Well, we didn't make any distinction between anybody. Here, we're going to go to twister space by Fourier transforming with respect to the lambdas for this guy, lambda 1, lambda 2, and with respect to the lambda tilde for the last guy. Okay. So e to the negative I, you know, mu tilde 1, lambda 1, e to the negative I, mu tilde 2, lambda 2, and e to the I, mu 3, lambda 3. So just like we have z variables that you can think of as mu's and lambdas, so we can have the conjugate variables w that you can think of mu tildes and lambda tildes, depending on who you did the transform with respect to. Okay, so times this. Now you can actually do this integral, and I'll leave it as an exercise. It's a three-line computation. But I just want to show you what the answer looks like, just so you can also sort of see a little historically how the fact that there's something very, very combinatorial underneath the Yang-Mills theory starts emerging. This answer turns out to be the following. This is the sine of W1.Z2 times the sine of W1.Z3 times something which I'll cheat and not tell you about right now. Sine means 1 if the variable is positive and 0 if the variable is negative, or negative 1 if the variable is negative. The three-point amplitude is 1s and minus 1s, depending on whether you're the inside or outside of certain regions in the corresponding twister spaces. And, sorry? Yeah, let me write the thing. So there. It's another sign. I should have maybe mentioned this. So if we want to talk about breaking of conformal invariants, remember we were talking about twister variables, so they have these four, they have four indices, one through four with an SL4 acting on them. And so the only things we can, the only things we have are the epsilon symbol to contract things with. If you break, so you just have Poincaré and not full conformal invariants, then we can talk about contractions like just the lambdas, two lambdas contracted with each other, for example, okay? Or two mu's contracted with each other. These are things that we're allowed to talk about. Without them, we have to contract four of them together at a time. But if we break conformal invariants, we have, this is just reflected in the fact that there is a, there is an antisymmetric tensor, a 4x4 matrix antisymmetric tensor, you could call it IIJ. It's known as the infinity twister. It's really a bi-twister, it's a matrix. So we can contract indices with these guys. Okay? So this really just means lambda 1, lambda 2. But it indicates the fact that it's not conformally invariant. So there's something actually very interesting, that there are these subtle breakings of conformal invariants when you transform into a twister space. And there, these things don't screw anything up. There's actually, they're physical. They're reflecting the fact that actually the scattering problem, the fact that you're beginning with incoming states and they go out, the actual, the question isn't exactly conformally invariant. And there are some small, subtle breakings of conformal invariants associated with that fact. So the amplitudes are sort of decorated with little things that break conformal invariants. But that's not important for the purposes of this discussion. Well, even with that, it's all ones and minus ones. All right. No, so it's a distribution, just like, right. So this was mostly just to give you a flavor that twister variables are nice, twister space is nice. In twister space, however, the amplitudes are distributions, and we only have a very controlled way of going back and forth to twister space in 2, 2 signature. All right. Yes. Oh, okay. Why don't we take a break and great. 15 minutes or whatever. 10 is fine. Great.